Everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, you guys, this is Scott Horton's show. Check out the full archives at scotthorton.org. 4,000 and something interviews going back to 2003 there for you now. And also libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. All the newest stuff goes there first. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Okay. Introducing our good friend Jim Bovard. He wrote a whole bunch of books. They're all really, really good. I won't do the whole list, but check out his Amazon page. My favorite, I have to say, is Attention Deficit Democracy. And no, he doesn't need a lecture from you about it's a republic, not a democracy. Please. It's in there. Such a great book. And of course, the latest is the memoir, Public Policy Hooligan. Before that, there's 10 or something going back to the 1980s that are really just great. And now he is on the editorial board or the something or other board at USA Today and wrote this great piece, Woodrow Wilson Made Democracy Unsafe for the World. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you, sir?
Hey, doing good, Scott. Thanks for your kind words.
Yeah, well, you deserve them. Everybody knows that. And, you know, I get, for whatever reason, they direct them to me. I don't know. But I get compliments about your work all the time.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah, people just say that Bovard is an incredible writer. Oh, Attention Deficit Democracy. Who was telling me this just the other day? Attention Deficit Democracy. Man, that's a great book, they were saying.
Well, damn, I never hear that.
Yeah. Well,
I'm joking.
You should get
I'm
out
joking.
More.
No, it's very nice that folks have kind words for the book. I mean, it was a lot of people hated it when it came out, but what the heck, it's still
that's
around.
That's because of how good it was.
Yeah. You know, I was on the wrong side of the torture issue, so. By a lot of people's standards, so.
Right. In other words, the right side of it. And you're quoted in my brand new book on the torture issue from that book, in fact.
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah. I won't spoil it for the audience. Let's talk about Woodrow Wilson, the father of Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong and Harry Truman and George W. Bush.
Well, I'm not sure if he was the father. I think his role might have been more closer to midwife, you know, because he certainly, you know, by plunging into the First World War and helping sow a vast amount of chaos in post-war Europe, that led to a lot of other wars. You know, President Wilson was very proud. He announced 14 principles of which he wanted to guide the peace treaty talks. But instead of that, Europe ended up with 14 separate wars by the time Wilson's presidency ended.
Absolutely amazing. And that was something that reminded me how little I know about the First World War, actually, when you talk about as the Versailles Conference was going on. At the end of the war, there were still this was the 14 wars, separate wars that were still raging. And
no, this is not 14 separate wars that were still raging. This is 14 wars, most of them were new wars, and they were partly the result of the making a hodgepodge of the European borders.
Oh, I see. What, so it's not that these were wars that were still going on from, like, smaller wars within World
right.
War One. This was after
right.
the conference when they drew the new borders, then new fighting broke out.
Right, right. It may have been some of them might have started during the conference when things were in flux,
right.
But there was just a horrendous amount of conflicts that made an absolute mockery of Wilson's attempt to label the First World War a war to end all wars or some other such hokum. So, but that was what should have been expected when the government told so many lies and you know, just there were all these dominoes falling, and it didn't matter what Woodrow Wilson thought; those dominoes were going to keep falling.
Okay, now, so I don't know what they tell the kids nowadays, but when I was a kid in school, they said, yeah, World War One caused World War Two. At the same time, though, you know how it is. They basically teach that everything that happened in history, certainly that the U.S. government did, it had to do at the time, because after all, it's a democracy, and the democracy decided, etc. And so it just goes without saying that it was right, it must have been right, that America did enter the war. But what you're, I think, breaking down here, you're saying that it's not just World War One. It's American intervention in World War One that made so much of the difference. Why is that so?
Well, I think if the U.S. had not intervened, that Germany, France, and Britain would have had to reach some kind of accommodation that most likely would have been much less disruptive than what the Versailles Treaty finally came out with. France was, so desperate for vengeance, as was Britain. In the 1918 election in Britain, and Lloyd George campaigned on a promise to hang the Kaiser. So, I mean, it was a very high-toned election. Most of the European powers had kind of fought themselves almost to exhaustion at the point that the U.S. intervened. And if the U.S. had not gotten in, things probably would have, things could almost not have worked out worse. Maybe that's the best way to put it, because I don't want to imply that the ending would have been happy or in any such sense, but it certainly made things worse for the U.S. to intervene and Wilson to be putting all the pressure on different levels. And there were so many things which Wilson turned a blind eye to, so many atrocities, such as the British government maintaining a food blockade on Germany for 6 months after the armistice, mm-hmm. which starved to death thousands of Germans and helped embitter them and helped sow a lot of seeds of radicalism that came to fruition in the 1930s.
Right. Well, and that's the whole thing, right, is, the absolute worst case scenario is Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. And yet, I mean, isn't that even the mainstream historian consensus that they're just, without the Versailles Treaty, no Hitler, right? Even Churchill says that.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, there was all kinds of things which helped pave the path to the Nazi takeover. But there are a lot of things in the Treaty of Versailles, and some of the actions of the French government and the British government afterwards certainly pushed Germany in that direction, though there was no excuse for people voting for Hitler. It's fascinating looking back on that on this day, since yesterday the Turks had a referendum on whether or not to make the Turkish leader a dictator. And according to the first polls I've seen, the vote for yes in favor of dictatorship won by a narrow margin. So,
yeah, that's certainly what they're claiming.
And yeah, I don't trust them, but that's another story.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have made much difference if the no vote had won over there at this point. Anyway, who's going to stop them? But
oh, it's very tragic, very tragic.
All right. Well, and so Turkey, that's another big part of this, right? And, in Jim Powell's book, he emphasizes the rise of Hitler and the rise of the communists in Russia, too, as a consequence of American intervention in the war and bribing the Kerensky government to stay in the war. We could get back to that if you want to address that. But also there's the Ottoman Empire, and the destruction of Turkish rule over Arab lands led to their possession by Britain and then eventually the United States.
The Britain and France both, because of the French and the British racing to carve up new empires. I mean, it's one of the, shall we say, ironies of the Wilson's War to make the world safe for democracy, that the British and the French expanded their colonies. And in most of those colonies, there was no democracy. So, it was another wrinkle that that you had President Wilson, tub thumping for democracy at the same time that the British were just brutally crushing the Irish, becoming far more heavy-handed there. Anyhow, there are so many different levels of hypocrisy here for this war, and it was a great tragedy for America and for much of the world.
All right, so talk a little bit about the changes in the relationship between the national government, the states, and the individual in America during the war in Europe.
Well, yeah, the thing that was the biggest impact in the short run was the military conscription. Back at the time that Wilson first pulled the U.S. into the war, people were given the impression that conscription might not be that necessary. But very few people, fewer than 100,000 men volunteered for the military after Wilson's appeal for a moral crusade. So Congress passed a law to make to allow the government to draft up to 10 million people, just to make sure they had enough cannon fodder. And once they had that, then they decide they also need to have an espionage law to make it a federal crime to criticize the draft. And so you had a huge amount of crackdowns on free speech, basically to try to shore up the conscription system.
Now, you know what I wonder? I've read a little bit of stuff about the riot, you know, just in the early years of World War II, people like Garrett Garrett saying, stay out, let Stalin and Hitler fight it out. There's no reason to jump into that. Let Hitler go east and this kind of, because otherwise what might happen? We could empower Stalin and then have to have a whole new problem to deal with. This kind of, in other words, really calling the score way ahead of time. Herbert Hoover, I guess, the former president, had taken this stand as well. But I wonder, when it comes to all the anti-war activism before World War I, how prescient were the critics about what the consequences might be of intervening in Europe? Were they just saying, hey, we shouldn't do this, George Washington said not to, and it's immoral, and Germany doesn't threaten us? Or were they even saying, geez, we might help the Brits tip the balance of power so badly that it ends up with this terrible backlash and all these repercussions?
Well, there were a handful of intellectuals and writers, people like H.L. Mencken, Randolph Bourne, and others who very clearly perceived the type of disasters that could follow from the U.S. intervention. But you had a very similar, tidal wave among intellectuals, the same as you had in 2002 and 2003 with the neocons and the Iraq War, that the top media all of a sudden became very much saber-rattling. And that was a lot of folks who were enthusiastic about having other people go fight. I think that was the case with Walter Lippmann, who was writing for the New Republic at that point. And I think he might have given some advice to Wilson as well. I'm not sure, but there were folks who saw the danger. It was a much cleaner argument for staying out of the first World War than the Second World War. I mean, given the atrocities that Germany was committing, the things it had done were far more jolting than what had happened in the First World War. Part of the reason that Americans did not react more strongly to some of the Second World War atrocities was because there had been so many false claims about atrocities in the First World War. The British propaganda operation had basically fabricated a lot of stories. Certainly the German occupation of Belgium, much of Belgium, did result in atrocities. There were thousands of innocent people killed, but that was hyped in a way that was became far more dominant in the American news media. And my impression is that the German atrocities that were committed in Belgium, anyhow, were not nearly as deadly as what the American troops did in the Philippines in the prior decade.
Mm-hmm. All right, now this is something that you're a real expert on, maybe the best in America,
God.
On American government intervention in our agricultural economy.
Oh, good.
And this is something
I was hoping for an easy question.
Yeah. Well, this is something that nobody really knows very much about. Of course, all good libertarians know that whenever there's a problem with the way things are working, you need to always ask what government did to make it this way in the first place before you start coming up with government solutions to them. But so we had a problem, right? I learned this in college that you had too many farmers producing too much stuff, and so they just couldn't get it right, man, with their crazy seasons and credit problems and things. And so the government had to come in and take over the agricultural industry. To continue to refuse to do so was madness, Jim.
Well, but almost nobody still recalls how the federal government wrecked American agriculture, wrecked it in the wake of the First World War. What happened during the war, you had Herbert Hoover, who was the food czar. He was encouraging, there was a mantra that food is going to win the war. And so there was a vast increase in the plantings. Government came in with price supports that sharply drove up crop prices. You had a lot of government credits for foreign buyers that sent land prices skyrocketing. And the farmers thought that they were going to be on the gravy train forever. But in 1920, the government ended the credits. Prices and land values plunged. And there were massive bankruptcies across rural America. What happened then was that the farmers felt like they had been cheated, and and that it was necessary to have a government takeover to guarantee them high prices like they'd had in the 1910s. So that was where the idea of parity came from. That was parity was a basically a moral doctrine masquerading as an economic policy. It never really made any sense, but it was the that was a compass for federal farm policy from the 1930s to the 1970s or 1980s, which is a sign of how lame-brained federal policymaking has been. So, but folks, very few folks have recognized that the federal takeover of agriculture in the 1930s was paved, the way for that was paved in the wake of the First World War. There were so many, that was another one of those things that you had private experts who were saying, look, you know, the agriculture economy is going way the hell out of whack. Once these credits end, there's going to be horrendous disruption. It was similar to what happened with the housing bust, 2007, 2008. You'd had Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other federal entities that just helped drive housing prices through the roof. And then all of a sudden, when those credits ended, boom, it was like a souffle collapsing. And that's what happened with the agricultural markets and agricultural land values after the First World War boom ended.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You know, there was once, I don't know if it's still available online anymore or what, I guess it was a headline from Our Dumb Century, the Onion book from 1917, where it's J.P. Morgan and, I don't know, Rockefeller and Carnegie congratulate Woodrow Wilson on getting us into the war in the first ever conference call. Something like
that's
that.
Funny.
But so anyways, what about that J.P. Morgan and his influence on the Woodrow Wilson administration? How much did that have to do with getting us into the war?
Good question. I don't know.
Oh, man, come on.
I mean, this is something which I've heard. I've read a lot more about the British influence. There's a couple of really good books I want to recommend. Thomas Fleming did a book in 2003 called The Illusion of Victory, American World War One. It's an absolute masterpiece, and it's very well written. I mean, that's the single best source I've found. Hunt Tooley also did a great book on the First World War on the Western Front. Hunt Tooley's a professor in Texas.
Great. Yeah, he was actually recommended to me by Tom Woods recently, too.
Hunt's a good fellow. He seems very friendly for a Texan.
Hey.
We're all very, very friendly. I just want to make sure you're paying attention.
That's what they say about us most of all, is how friendly we are, us Texans.
Well, you know, I haven't heard that from people in Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, what do they know about it?
Well, anyhow.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Hey, so now here's the thing about it. Everybody knows that when Roosevelt mobilized the American people and industry for World War II, that was it, Jack. We've been mobilized ever since. Perpetual war for perpetual peace. Since 1941 on, at least. I mean, maybe there was a little bit of a lull in 1946, some say. I don't know. But not much of one. But so, what about World War I and the so-called Merchants of Death? I guess military-industrial complex was the euphemism that the advertising people had come up with by 1960. But what about that and the distortions in the industrial economy in preparation and in participation in World War One?
Good question. Hunt Tooley's probably done some good stuff on that. Jim Powell might have done some good stuff on that. That was not my article, and it's something which I'm cold on at the moment. So,
oh man, well, I'm just surprising you all over the place.
Well,
just say,
you know,
it wrecked it, Scott. It screwed up everything, just like in agriculture, man. It made these businessmen think,